وآل محمد.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Lebanon is without a president. Lebanon's outgoing head of state, Michel Aoun, has vacated the presidential palace one day before his mandate expired without a designated successor. To further deepen the political crisis in that country, Aoun also has said that he signed a decree formalizing the resignation of Najib Mikati's caretaker government, this on top of the economic woes of the country. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how Lebanon just averted a war with the signing of a historic maritime deal, one in which Israel was left with no choice but to sign without Lebanon formalizing ties with it, unlike other Persian Gulf Arab regimes.
History repeats itself once more in Lebanon as President Michel Aoun steps out of a presidential palace, which will remain vacant for an unknown period of time. Addressing flocks of supporters, Aoun said a chapter has ended in Lebanon's politics and a new chapter will begin.
A new phase begins, and this new phase requires struggle and work to exit our crises. The country is looted, and we have to carry out a lot of efforts to uproot corruption.
Aoun talked about the recent agreement with Israel to demarcate Lebanon's maritime borders. He said the deal secured the nation's access to its natural resources, adding that the future revenues should be used to repair the Lebanese economy.
The demarcation of our maritime border will allow us to extract the national treasure of petrol and gas, which would grant us the needed capital to come out of our economic and financial crisis. We hope to see a sovereign fund that would be used for development and also for the upcoming generations.
Aoun took office in 2016. His was marred by mass protests, a severe economic crisis, and currency collapse, and the August 2020 portside blast that killed hundreds. President Michel Aoun ends his term today at a time when Lebanon is deeply divided on various issues, but it was this term that has given Lebanon what experts are calling a golden opportunity to become a gas exporter and salvage its economy. President Aoun does not only leave behind a country without a head of state, but he goes back to his residency. The political divide remains quite entrenched, and experts see that the maritime border deal proves that the West has lifted its undeclared blockade on Lebanon.
In Lebanon, we are not usually good at seizing opportunities, but we benefited from the opportunity of demarcating the maritime border. Since there was a Western interest in having a stability in the Mediterranean region and allowing Lebanon to extract its resources. But will the Lebanese seize this opportunity to form an agreement which could result in the election of a president? We are waiting for the upcoming hours, which could evolve into security threats or perhaps surprises.
Lebanese lawmakers have failed to agree on electing a successor for Aoun, with no side having a clear majority to impose a candidate to succeed him. A caretaker government has been in place since the parliamentary elections last spring, and with no hope in forming a new cabinet in the last hours of Aoun's term, political divisions are expected to deepen until the election of a new president. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me first introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Elijah Bankner joins us. He's a journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Also joining us, Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator from London. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Elijah Bankner, first to you. Lebanon's President Michel Aoun has now left that position that he held, and the ceremony today was quite a remarkable one in terms of the turnout. Anyways, one of the problems is there is no, at this point, designated successor. So what kind of legacy, as a general question, I should ask you, has he left behind? And how do you think this void will now impact Lebanon?
Thank you for having me. This is the first time in the history of Lebanon where a president leaves the presidential palace with a resigned government and with a total disagreement among the strong political parties, not able to form a government before the end of the president's mandate, and without the visibility that there is going to be an agreement among the political parties. So we have the strong Christian party group, the Tayar, that is the party of the president, led by his son-in-law, who has a strong party, and he has 17 to 18 MPs in the parliament, and is an ally of Hezbollah, and they have created a long, strong, and robust support throughout the last years. However, the candidate to the presidency is not yet agreed upon because, as your correspondent rightly said, there is no agreement so far and nobody holds a majority in the parliament. So the problem now is the power will go to the parliament, and the speaker is a Shia that is not going to be accepted by the Sunni community, particularly the prime minister, who is in agreement with the speaker, a Shia speaker, Nabih Berri. However, they don't agree on passing on the power from the Sunni that normally should hold the legislation. The Shia hold the legislation and the Sunni the executive power. So this kind of very strange and ambiguous situation in Lebanon needs the agreement of the major political parties that are not yet ready to sit because they have demand. And as I said, the son-in-law of the president, Jubran Basile, has demands in the new parliament. He wants six ministers, and the prime minister doesn't agree with his demand, and the whole point is to weaken Basile in the new government. So this kind of disagreement pushed Hezbollah to pull out of the government. If ever there is going to be a meeting of the called by the prime minister, and that leaves the country into very ambiguous situation. However, this is also a situation where everybody is going to be forced to sit around the table and start a serious dialogue to try and smooth the pass on of power and how to form a new government.
Well, that invitation could be maybe easy to send out, say, Mohsen Abbas, to sit around the table. But as our guest there said, neither Hezbollah has any domination in terms of a clear majority that's needed, nor its opponents. So how can this deadlock be solved, do you think?
Well, I think, common sense has to prevail. Lebanon finds itself on the border of the most imperialist force in West Asia, Israel. Lebanon needs to remember that Israel has invaded it several times and unsuccessfully, largely because of the Islamic resistance or the resistance axis itself in that region, Hezbollah particularly, obviously, on the front line. Lebanon needs to recognize that unity internally will lead to strength in terms of maintaining the sovereignty of Lebanon, because make no mistake, most of the socioeconomic woes, most of the political maneuverings that are going on have got big money behind them. Most of these people who are playing the games which keep Lebanon on a knife edge politically and economically are either in the pockets of the Americans, the Israelis, or the Saudis. There's a lot of money floating around for a lot of corrupt people in the background. Now, within all of that, Hezbollah, Amal, and others have done their level best to steer away from anything which will lead to a civil war. Because don't also forget that Lebanon was embroiled in a decades-long civil war, which was hugely bloody as well. And I think none of the Lebanese people need to be reminded of that scenario and what that entails. They can take heart and perhaps, I'd say, perhaps look towards this particular deal with Israel and look at the reasons why they were successful in terms of negotiating a maritime deal, really quite an unprecedented territorial deal with Israel, because Israel, don't forget, never gives away borders. I mean, it considers its borders to be legitimate from the sea to the Euphrates as per their Odin Yinon plan or their periphery doctrine.
So why did they?
The fact that they've managed to force Israel into an agreement is a huge sign for the Lebanese people and themselves, that the unity of the leadership, which there was unity in this negotiation amongst the officials, and also the military power of Hezbollah in particular, both persuaded Israel to back off from the option of war, because that's what it was. When they got their Greek ship in to extract the oil from the disputed waters, it was Hezbollah who jumped in, said Nasrallah, to actually threaten Israel. So I think that there's a lot of thought and reflection they must do around the idea of unity and its benefit for the sovereignty and the independence and the existence of Lebanon.
Elijah Magner, I guess there are talks about the maritime deal and also unity. So let's break that down a little bit. First, let's take the idea of unity. It doesn't appear that there's much unity when you're having the Mikati government to remain in this caretaker role since the elections in spring, and then you have Aoun, who has formalized a decree for the resignation of Mikati's caretaker government. Can you please tell us what the problem was there, and the friction between the two?
Since President Aoun took power, and almost everybody, at the exception of Hezbollah, worked to defeat Aoun and to cripple his ruling, to tell the world that this is the worst president ever because of his unity with Hezbollah and because Aoun was promoted by Hezbollah to power, because he was a general who supported the cause of the resistance, stood against Israel overtly, stood against the Americans when they wanted to isolate Hezbollah without being an anti-American. And because of that, he needed to pay the price. So the Americans, the Saudis, and all the Gulf countries who are oil rich and they have a lot of money and they used to support Lebanon, stopped all the support, did everything to show that Aoun is the worst president. They prevented the electricity to come in the country, be provided, even when they were offered by China to rebuild the infrastructure of the country. Russia did the same. Iran offered oil through Hezbollah twice. And then now it's offering to the Lebanese government, and still the government is hesitant. Why? Because in Lebanon is divided between those who are afraid of the Americans and those who are not afraid to challenge the Americans for the benefit of the population. So Aoun is one of these people who is not afraid to say to the Americans, Hezbollah is to represent the Lebanese society. It represents more than a third of the Lebanese society. It is not a group that is detached from Lebanon, is Lebanese, has nowhere else to go. And you have to live with it because he is defending the sovereignty of the country. And as your guest rightly mentioned, the maritime border, it was due to Hezbollah that this was reached. So all these imposed on the president as a heavy burden. Either you drop Hezbollah or you do what we want, or you're going to be completely isolated. And this is what happened. Now, Mikati is a businessman. He's very rich. He has his money abroad. And he is afraid of the sanctions because the Americans can exert their perfect hobby to impose sanctions on individual and country when they don't follow their own policy. Uh-huh. So because because of that, Mikati needs to accommodate the Americans, and because of that, Aoun has been completely isolated, and this is why today he's leaving, and he signed just a few hours before his departure the resignation of the government of Mikati, because Mikati wasted time not to agree on a new government to include all the strong political party, because he wanted to accommodate the Americans.
Well, you would think that Mikati would have a change of stance there, Saim Hossein Abbas, because as you mentioned, that this was a historic deal, as many have said, this was a historic deal. But this was also a deal, and that's the issue that needs to be talked about here, which it wasn't so much that Israel had really a choice, did it? Because if it was to go ahead with what it was doing, it would face the specter of war. At the same time, then there was the decision made, and correct me if I'm wrong, the decision was, should we go to war with Hezbollah or should we not? And the decision was made, we shouldn't. The fact that they didn't, doesn't it show that Israel then was afraid to go to war because it would, in its calculations, know that it would lose that war?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the signs of Israel's relative weakness have been borne out even more by their failure to take on Hezbollah. Hezbollah very clearly put forward three unarmed drones and sent them towards the Israeli gas rig at that time. And Sayyid Nasrallah warned that no one would drill gas as long as the Lebanese rights to extract were not upheld. He made it absolutely clear that Hezbollah was right on the verge of being at war with Israel over this. Israel stared back at Hezbollah, and ultimately it's Israel that's blinked first, because Israel has quite clearly conceded on the disputed territories almost 100% of its initial negotiating position. You know, even Ehud Adiri, who was the lead negotiator, actually resigned 1 week before the agreement, which indicates why Benjamin Netanyahu has been talking of this deal as a capitulation to Hezbollah specifically. You know, so clearly there's a direct link. 879 square kilometers of oil and gas-rich territories. Israel would never give these away unless it actually feared Hezbollah's armed resistance. And Sayyid Nasrallah hasn't just taken the credit for himself on this. He's made it clear that he was supported by everybody from the Palestinian resistance, who during this period were offering a complementary resistance internally within the land of so-called Israel, but also the Yemeni resistance, the Iraqi resistance, and many others were clearly offering their support. When it looked like there was going to be potential war between Lebanon or Hezbollah and Israel, the resistance axis and the resistance front started to come together very powerfully. And I think that acknowledging that is terribly important, because for the future, what it tells us is that Israel is not up against just Hezbollah now. It has several other problems. Syria, of course, I didn't mention in the previous list, but they too were in total support. And let's not forget that Israel occupies the Golan Heights, where Genie Oil extract Syrian oil day in, day out. The Americans steal it from the west side of Syria, or rather the east side of Syria. But Genie Oil continue to extract oil from the Golan Heights. Will certainly have been making huge preparations for it, and nobody has been able to take that back from them. Sure. Here, what we find is Hezbollah has stopped Israeli theft of Lebanese gas and oil.
All right. One thing that's very confusing, Elijah Magnier, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah spoke last night, and he did speak about the fact that based on the availability of the gas or natural resources as a whole in that area, Palestine also has a share of this. But it's somewhat confusing as to how the deal was made and whether Palestine is going to get a share out of these natural resources or not. And what role would Lebanon have in this matter, or if it has been actually set aside in the deal provisions that entitle Palestine to any of those natural resources. Can you tell us what the deal is there?
This is a very tricky question. Actually, the reason why Said Nasrallah and Hezbollah was not involved in the negotiation and kept some distance in many details is because there is an ideological problem here, issue that Hezbollah respects and is not ready to bypass or to close an eye on, considering that this is a Palestinian territory, it's a Palestinian sea, and this is why Hezbollah is not interfering in small details. And the biggest mistake the Israelis made is to leave these 2.3 kilometers or 2.5 kilometers that they refused to negotiate on, because that will give more reason for Hezbollah not only to exist as a military resistance, but to say we need to liberate this part because it belonged to Lebanon, and the rest belonged to Palestine, not to the Israelis, because this deal was never signed with the Israelis. It was signed between the Israelis and the Americans, between the Lebanese and the Americans, and there is no recognition whatsoever of Israel because it is considered still as an enemy, and the territory belongs to Palestine. Now, in the deal was made with the companies that are in charge of extracting the gas, and the company will give the Lebanese share as it was agreed previously, and Lebanon has nothing to do with the benefit of what the company that are going to be in charge of extracting the gas are going to be with their share. If they give part of it to Israel or not, that is their business. This is where Hezbollah kept a distance, because Hezbollah consider all this part needs to be liberated and returned to the Palestinians because it is their legitimate land and sea.
Very well. Thank you for mentioning the fact about who signed the deal with whom, because the question that has come about is that some have said this deal amounts to Beirut recognizing Israel. And, of course, given the signatures that you said, then that clarifies that, which brings me to the final point, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas. This deal, another significant aspect of it was that Lebanon did not have to formalize its relationship when it comes to Israel the way that other Arab countries have done. How significant is that? In under a minute, please.
Well, it's very significant because ideologically, of course, the resistance stands by no normalization with Israel. They regard Israel as an illegal entity and an alien entity. And I think this, of course, has been a very, very astute move, because they can't be accused essentially of being hypocrites or having double standards. The war footing with Israel still exists. The disputes with Israel still exists. The non-recognition of the illegitimate nature of the colonial settler state still exists. The support for the Palestinian resistance by Hezbollah and other resistance front forces still exists. So actually, nothing has changed from an ideological point of view. There is still an absolute disdain and disregard for the apartheid nature of Israel, and a disdain for the fact that they've stolen Palestinian land, and that they represent an existential threat to the security and peace of West Asia, and the primary threat to that peace. So it's as you were from that point of view, and certainly they can also point back to the likes of the United Arab Emirates, that is the Lebanese negotiators. They can say, look, this is how it's done. We can put Israel into a position of, if you like, weakness and giving, rather than the way you've operated with them, with the so-called Abraham Accords, and the way Bahrain, the UAE, and even Saudi on the quiet are all behaving towards Israel, which is to say, look, we
okay,
want to
thank you.
We can do deals and do
Sorry.
What you like. So
yeah.
There's a big difference, yes.
I apologize. We're fresh out of time. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator. Elijah McNear, thank you so much. Journalist and political analyst from Brussels. With that, we'll come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikova Tahwe, it's goodbye until the next Spotlight.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم رب هب لي حكما وألحقني بالصالحين.
And he said, My Lord, grant me authority and join me with the righteous.
Dear listeners, as you were previously with us, we reached the 83rd verse of this chapter, Surah Ash-Shu'ara, to be discussed. The verse reads, رَبِّ هَبْ لِي حُكْمًا وَأَلْحِقْنِي بِالصَّالِحِينَ. My Lord, bestow wisdom on me and join me with the righteous. Throughout the previous verses, we all understood how Prophet Abraham introduced his Lord, and he described what true Lord must be to be deserving, to be worshipped. الَّذِي خَلَقَنِي فَهُوَ يَهْدِينَ وَالَّذِي هُوَ يُطْعِمُنِي وَيَسْقِينَ. He starts with creation, guidance, feeding and providing people to drink. وَإِذَا مَرَضْتُ فَهُوَ يَشْفِينَ. Such a God needs to heal you when you are sick, and he is the one who causes you to die and gives you life afterwards, and you must be having hopes on him to forgive you your mistakes on the Day of Judgment. So Prophet Abraham nullified the superstitious imaginations of these gods they were worshipping. And now this verse, رَبِّ هَبْ لِي حُكْمَ. My Lord, bestow wisdom on me. The Quranic word hukm mentioned here can be in the sense of government, guardianship, and the management of the affairs, or it can be used with the meaning of knowledge and cognition. The word hukm, of course, has a meaning more than hikmah and wisdom and theology, because hikmah is only the power of recognition between the right and wrong, but hukm is a cognizance that is accompanied with preparation for executing the right. Anyway, from this verse on, the supplications of Abraham and his beseeching before the presence of Allah begins. رَبِّ حَبْ لِي حُكْمًا وَأَلْحِقْنِي بِالصَّالِحِينَ.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
we
approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So from this verse on, this is the supplication of Abraham before the presence of Allah. It seems that after inviting that misguided people onto Allah and stating the manifestations of his lordship in the world of existence, Prophet Abraham becomes completely hopeless of them. He turns to the presence of Allah. He asks him whatever he wants, so that he shows those idolaters that whatever they desire for this life, and of course the next life, they ought to ask him. By the way, this matter is another emphasis on the absolute lordship of Allah, and this is really interesting, that by merely changing your addressee within a story, within an incident, an event, you mean something, actually, and something is implied. Prophet Abraham was describing his Lord to them, and yet he suddenly changes the addressee. He was talking to them, now he's talking to his Lord. رَبِّ هَبْ لِي حُكْمًا وَأَلْحِقْنِي بِالصَّالِحِينَ My Lord, bestow wisdom on me, and join me with the righteous. When, right after he finished describing the God, وَالَّذِي أَطْمَعَ أَنْ يَغْفِرَ لِي خَطِيئَةِ يَوْمَ الدِّينِ He is the one whom I hope who will forgive me my mistakes on the day of judgment. And this is another aspect of the miracle of the Holy Quran. So what does he ask from his Lord? He is, in short term, asking his salvation and reaching the divine mercy. So this is what Prophet Abraham asks Allah. The cognition and inner understanding of him. Habli hukma. This is how we translate hukm in this verse. Wa alhiqni bis-salihin. Being in the presence and being accompanied with other righteous people. So in order to be successful, in order to reach salvation, it's not enough for you alone to be close to God. You need to have a society of righteous people. We'll discuss more, brothers and sisters, in the next episode, God willing. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
You
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Palestinians rallied in the blockaded Gaza Strip to express their solidarity with people in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces have stepped up their crackdown, carrying out attacks across the occupied territories and the city of Al-Quds in recent weeks. This while more than 130 Palestinians have been killed by regime forces in the West Bank this year alone, amid an increase in armed resistance. Palestinian resistance factions have expressed their unwavering support for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
As we stand here, we affirm the unity of the Palestinian people in the face of the Zionist enemy. Palestinian resistance factions will always stand by our people in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank in the face of Zionist crimes. We will continue our armed resistance until the liberation of Palestine.
While Israeli forces increase their attacks in the occupied West Bank, extremist Jewish settlers have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds under the silent, watchful eye of the international community.
Today we are sending a message of solidarity to our brethren in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. The armed resistance will only increase for the sake of Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. The Zionist occupation only understands the language of force, and we will continue the fight until martyrdom or freedom.
During the rally, Palestinian resistance groups warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank, while asserting that armed resistance is the key to freedom.
We are loyal to armed resistance and to the blood of martyrs who sacrificed their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds. We are fighting for a just cause, and nothing will break the resistance against the Zionist enemy. The criminal Zionist enemy has committed crimes against the Palestinians in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank, and it will pay for the crimes.
Palestinians say they want the occupied West Bank to be part of a future independent Palestinian state with Al-Quds as its capital. People here vow to utilize all forms of resistance to defend Al-Quds against Israeli aggression. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Earlier this month, Brussels approved the eighth round of sanctions on Russia over the conflict in Ukraine in an attempt to deprive Moscow of billions of euros in revenues from selling products in the European Union. In a previous round of sanctions, the sixth, Brussels had approved an embargo on Russian seaborne oil that will come into force on December the 5th. This punitive measure will severely affect the ISAB refinery, located on Sicily Island in the south of Italy. The refinery, owned by the Russian multinational energy corporation Lukoil, used to buy about 40% of its feedstock from Moscow. Due to the embargo, the plant could shut down in a few weeks, leaving thousands of people jobless.
These workers have been on permanent employment contracts for many years. They are very worried about what lies ahead. A closure of the refinery would reverberate on the region's satellite activities, affecting about 10,000 workers. We have received assurances from the new government that a positive solution will be found.
Although Lukoil was not singled out by EU sanctions, the ISAB plant, which accounts for around 20% of Italian refining capacity, has been forced to rely solely on Russian oil since international banks are no longer providing the refinery with credit to buy oil from alternative suppliers.
Per quanto riguarda queste sanzioni sul petrolio,
EU financial sanctions usually contain derogation provisions which allow competent authorities to authorize activities that would otherwise be prohibited. These provisions should be immediately applied to the ISAB refinery case. This embargo on Russian oil will only have the consequence of further damaging the EU's energy market.
A last shipment of Russian oil is expected to reach the ISAB refinery by December the 5th. The Italian government has a bit over a month to find a solution to the issue.
There seems to be two ways only to avert the closure of the ISAB plant. Either the refinery gets nationalized and the Italian government is reportedly mulling over this option, or it is sold to non-Russian buyers. Some media have reported that US private equity fund Crossbridge is among parties interested in buying the refinery. Actually, there is also a third option that could work for ISAB: continue the same way as today. But that would imply a normalization of ties between the EU and Russia, an option that seems non-viable at this stage. Max Civili, Rome.
Rohingya refugees in the suburbs of New Delhi are being threatened by a new onslaught against their community. They claim some men have attacked and beaten women and children living in the refugee camp. One of the women is critically injured and being treated in the hospital. Local residents claim refugee children had blocked a narrow road in the locality, while the members of the Rohingya community maintain they have nowhere to go. Meanwhile, the city police filed a complaint and an investigation is underway.
It's the government that sent us here after our camp was burnt down mysteriously. Our children have nowhere else to play or go. This is not the first time we have been beaten up. We don't want any trouble as we are already facing a lot of misery. Our children don't even have the privilege to go to school. What other options do they have?
India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees based on official figures, but reports suggest there are hundreds of thousands living across many parts of the country. Recent expulsion drives from the government have forced many to go into hiding in undisclosed locations, fearing detention, deportation and separation. The Indian government in recent years has taken the issue of these refugees to the parliament, with majority of the members calling them a security threat and therefore demanding their deportation. Rights activists have time and again reminded the administration about their plight, urging them for an immediate halt to any deportation plan. The destitute community is in utter desperation as intimidation, detention, deportation and night raids have become the order of the day. The Indian government calls them a security threat and prone to radicalization. For decades, the minority community faced systematic persecution at home in Buddhist-majority Myanmar. In recent years, the UN has accused Myanmar of genocide after hundreds of thousands fled to neighboring Bangladesh. Rights activists say the ruling BJP is fueling resentment since it won election in 2014. It calls the Rohingya a security threat, while the policy for refugees from other countries remains different. Persecuted Rohingya Muslims are being treated as illegal immigrants wherever they have settled after fleeing carnage in Myanmar. They are now living in makeshift camps as refugees across different parts of South Asia, especially in India, Bangladesh and Malaysia. Activists in India have stressed the urgent need to protect their rights as refugees. They urge the Indian government to formulate a uniform refugee policy to treat refugees equally, regardless of caste, ethnicity or faith.
On the third day of a public mourning in the southern Iranian city of Shiraz, following a terrorist attack on the holy shrine of Shah Cheragh, a huge crowd of people from different walks of life took part in the funeral procession of the victims.
I tell the enemies that we support the establishment and no one can harm it. We will be victorious.
I came to this rally to show that we are united. Iranian people should support each other and stay united so that Iran does not turn into a country like Syria.
At least 15 people were confirmed dead in the terrorist attack on Wednesday, among them women and children.
If you were truly courageous, you would fight in the battlefield, just like what General Soleimani did. But you attack a holy religious place and kill women and children. This is inhumane.
Tens of thousands of mourners from different walks of life took part in the event. Holding pictures of the victims and chanting slogans, the participants condemned terrorism and those behind the vicious act of terror in Shiraz.
It was our duty to take part in this event, and I tell the terrorists who committed this crime that killing us would only make the Iranian nation more conscious.
The mourners also chanted slogans against the supporters of Daesh terrorist group, particularly the United States and Israel. The coffins of the martyrs were then flown to the northeastern city of Mashhad, which houses the mausoleum of 8th Shia Imam Imam Reza, where thousands of mourners bid farewell to the victims.
Shedding the blood of innocent civilians in a religious holy shrine is a heinous crime denounced by people globally. Presence of a huge crowd of people in the funeral of martyrs of Shiraz terror attack shows the Iranian nation's unity in the face of enemies who seek to undermine the country's security. Mahdi Abbasian, Shiraz.
The elegant streets of historic Sevastopol. Ukraine and NATO still claim this city and the rest of Crimea as part of Ukraine, despite the 2014 referendum on joining Russia. Down by the harbour, I wanted to know how people feel about Ukrainian threats of taking back this city.
Crimea is not baggage to transfer in and out. People don't want to return to Ukraine, and they never identified as Ukrainian.
I don't want Crimea to return to Ukraine. We are Russian. We speak Russian. We were raised as Russian, and we have Russian culture. I was born in 1986, and never in my life did I feel myself Ukrainian. I have Ukrainian citizenship, but all my life I considered myself Russian and living in a Russian city.
My personal opinion was Crimea was Russian and remains Russia. I'm an ordinary man and this is my opinion. It will be bad if someone wants to take away Crimea. But I'm against the war that is going on. It's terrible what is going on in my beloved Russia.
A Russian fighter jet flies overhead, a common occurrence, perhaps returning from a combat mission in Kherson. Sometimes cruise missiles can be seen from the harbour, fired by Russia's Black Sea Fleet, which is based in the city.
Let them dream. It's not harmful to dream. We are at home. Nobody asked our opinion when Crimea became part of Ukraine. We were forced to become Ukrainian citizens. 30 years later, we returned home. We were tormented and were worried. Ukrainians were treating us badly. Everyone here is Russian.
Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine in 1954. Many see that as a historic mistake, not reflective of the wishes of locals.
Now, I have found a couple of people who are more pro-Ukrainian. They don't want to say their views openly, and they do tend to be from a younger demographic born after the fall of the Soviet Union. But even amongst that age group, they are very much in the minority.
Yeah. So Ukraine and NATO say that they want to take back Crimea from Russia. How do you feel about that?
I wish you good luck. Let's try. They can try, but they won't at all. It's a Russian place. What can I say more?
That's all. We are Russians.
While Russia and Ukraine continue to claim this city as their own, one thing is not in doubt. The vast majority of people living here want to be part of the Russian Federation. Chernomyl, Sevastopol, Crimea.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has been under pressure for his hardline policy against North Korea, as tensions increase amid renewed large-scale military exercises with the U.S. This week, he sought to reassure the National Assembly and the public.
We will strengthen deterrence against North Korea with overwhelming capabilities through combined defense posture between South Korea and the U.S. and the trilateral security cooperation between South Korea, the U.S., and Japan, so that our people can continue their daily lives without worry.
Progressive civil society worries the Korean Peninsula has fallen into crisis, with unification becoming more and more remote. They oppose the military exercises, demanding an end to the drills and a rethinking of South Korea's alliance with the United States.
From the 31st, the South Korean and U.S. forces will conduct the largest ever joint air war exercise in Korea, with 250 Air Force units deployed to strike hundreds of strategic bases in North Korea at the same time. The Korean Peninsula should not be an outpost for American hegemony in the world. This land should not be an American war base.
The U.S.-South Korea drills have continued since the end of August, following North Korea's testing of dozens of ballistic missiles. South Korea this week staged a large-scale amphibious landing drill. North Korea views such military exercises as a rehearsal for invasion. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has emphasized the need for the U.S. to show a strong commitment toward extended deterrence, the so-called nuclear umbrella. But that may not be enough, with stronger conservative voices here calling for South Korea to develop its own nuclear weapons. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Lebanon and Israel have finalized the U.S. brokered deal aimed at resolving a maritime dispute. President Michel Aoun signed a letter on Thursday endorsing the agreement. The final paperwork was submitted to the United Nations in Naqoura, southern Lebanon, concluding a long path of indirect negotiations with the Israeli regime. Separately, the Israeli cabinet, led by Prime Minister Yair Lapid, also approved the agreement. The regime's representative then delivered the signed copy to the UN at the Naqoura point. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. Nasrallah also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue. The Hezbollah leader said the agreement is not an international treaty.
What happened in Naqoura is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein, who was with the Lebanese delegation in the southern Lebanese town of Naqoura, had met the top Lebanese officials.
I truly believe and hope that this can be an economic turning point in Lebanon for a new era of investment and continued support to lift up the economy and make sure that whatever arrangements happen, they're done openly, transparently, and making sure that the benefits are felt directly by all the Lebanese people.
Experts believe this agreement would put Lebanon on the map of natural gas exporters. President Michel Aoun stressed in his statement that demarcating the southern maritime border is a technical matter that has no political implications and won't change his country's policy towards the Israeli regime. U.S. President Joe Biden has hailed the maritime border deal as a historic breakthrough. For Lebanon, it unlocks the possibility to exploit its own natural resources at a time when the West is seeking gas suppliers and looking for alternatives to Russian gas. Maryam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
Many millions of people living across the 27-nation EU are struggling to survive. Brussels resident Jefferson Araujo has endured two rent increases since March. His landlord says her mortgage is going up, and so a further rent hike is needed.
You go to the market, you cannot buy anything anymore because the price is too high. And I'm thinking maybe to leave Brussels because I'm working in a hotel 10 hours a day. Like sometimes I have just one day off a week.
In an attempt to bring down soaring inflation, the European Central Bank, which manages the euro, has announced interest rates are going up by a further 75 basis points. That represents a huge increase for people repaying home loans. The economic outlook could get even worse, the ECB warns.
Confidence could deteriorate further, and supply-side constraints could worsen again. Energy and food costs could also remain persistently higher than expected.
Some EU leaders have warned the ECB that increasing interest rates so aggressively could push the eurozone into a deep recession. Higher rates impede business expansion and employment. Charities fighting social injustice often point out all of those taking the decisions that lead to higher inflation and interest rates are insulated from the impact simply because they are the richest individuals in society. Critics say the EU's move to cut out Russia's cheap gas over the war in Ukraine is backfiring. Despite this, a ninth round of sanctions against Moscow is being prepared.
The Commission and the EES are obviously constantly working in the context of the sanctions on making sure that we are ready should there be a need for further sanctions.
Peace seems to be a dirty word in Western capitals. This as the US weapons and energy sectors make enormous profits, while ordinary EU citizens pay a very high price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iranians have held nationwide rallies to condemn the Wednesday terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz. The protesters took to the streets in different cities following Friday prayers. They chanted slogans and held banners, calling for the perpetrators and their backers to be brought to justice.
Today, we're here to show the world that we are all together. We are a powerful country. We're going to fight against terrorism. We're going to fight against violence. You want us to be separated. You want us to fight against each other, but we are the one. We are powerful.
At least 13 people, including two children, were killed after gunmen opened fire on pilgrims at the Shah Charagh Holy Shrine in Shiraz. 26 others were wounded. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility shortly after the attack.
We strongly condemn any acts of terrorism and desecration of Muslim sanctities. We want to say that we hate London-based news channels like Iran International, Manoto, and BBC because they are instigating violence and unrest in Iran.
We are here to send this message to Israel, the U.S., and their allies that through creating riots and unrest in the country, they cannot achieve their sinister goal of disintegration of Iran. We are united.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on security agencies, the judiciary, intellectuals, activists, and the entire nation to act in unison to confront the current which is disregarding and disrespecting people's lives.